So, how's the conference been so far? Good? Yeah? A system, a proper system center conference. Thanks very much. So Anders and I are going to talk about not system center today. So thanks for joining us for optimizing Azure VMs for performance and availability. My name is Pete Zerger. I'm a cloud and data center MVP, as Cameron said. I'm also a principal program manager for a software company called Cyrosyn,
you look like
who you'll find in the hallway. And joining me.
My name is Anders Bengtsson. I'm a principal PFE working with cloud and data center automation. I'm a former MVP.
It's a long time ago, man.
Yeah, that's many years ago.
Amazing. So we're going to, it's going to feel like we're a bit all over the place today. So just show of hands to start. How many of you in here have worked with virtual machines in Azure at least once? Like set up a trial sub, etc. So a lot of hands. So if you haven't, we should get you there. But it's going to feel a bit like we're all over the place today because we actually are. We're going to talk to you about how to optimize your approach, whether it's virtual machines, it's Azure storage, it's high availability. We're going to touch on Active Directory, which is really going to be an important piece of plumbing if you're connecting your corporate data center to Azure. We'll talk about scaling in and up and down and out with Azure Automation, because Azure Automation is Anders' answer to
everything.
Virtually everything.
More or less.
More or less.
Yeah.
But our goal is basically to share with you all of the lumps we've taken, the lessons we've learned over the last couple of years. So you go back to the office and you're ready to put a smackdown on any naysayers.
This one is really good. it's a really good book.
Great bathroom reading, coffee table book.
Yeah, spicy lunch, yeah.
Let's not go there. Wow. You can dress him up, you just can't take him out. So let's start with Azure Virtual Machine sizing. So the first thing you've probably noticed is that with Azure Virtual Machines, we can't go in and tune our VM and pick exactly how many cores, exactly how much memory. We have to pick an image size. You'll notice that in Azure today, you'll see a basic tier, you'll see a standard tier, and the difference between basic and standard, there are actually three or four differences. So the first is your disks will give you up to about 300 IOPS in basic, and when you go to standard, you get about 500. And there are a couple of other bits that basic VMs won't do.
Exactly, like auto-scaling and load balancing. They won't do that.
Yeah, so basic VMs are going to be great for test and dev.
Yeah, so basic for testing and then testing dev scenarios, and then you use the standard ones for your production machines.
Yeah, so you pick an image size, and it's very scientific. You look at roughly what you need in terms of cores and memory on-prem, and you go pick an image that more or less matches that. As of, in the last just little bit here, virtual machines can now have multiple NICs.
And yes, there's fantastic.
Kind of a formula for that, yeah?
Yes, there is. So it's something like this, easily said. 2 cores, 1 NIC. 4 cores, 2 NICs. Hang with me. Pete, 8 cores.
I do math really good. 4 NICs.
Very good.
Yeah,
very good.
Thank you. So you'll notice that we go all the way from A0 up to G5, which actually stood for Godzilla.
Yep.
And it can get up to 32,000 IOPS. So if that is not enough IO for you, you can go to a D, DS, or G series with premium storage. It gets us up to what now?
50,000.
Yeah, so 50K IOPS. So you can run some tier one serious workloads in there.
That's true.
I think we need to talk about optimization.
Oh, you kept that one.
Which we'll get to in a minute. Yeah, what is this?
So, I called it.
So I was on a plane somewhere. You all have heard of WWJD, right? So God is good, but my God doesn't, talk to me much about Azure. So I came up with WWAD. What would Anders do? So the global answer to that question, what would Anders do is, something inappropriate, just insert it there. But with regards to Azure VMs, let's talk.
Yes, so about the multiple NICs. You can only, if you want to have a VM with multiple NICs, you have to set that up when you create the VM. You can't go in there and after add another NIC. So it has to be done when you create the VM.
Okay.
Or, of course, you can rebuild the VM. So you could, it's not many clicks there. You could, if you have a VM running, you shut it down, you delete it, but you say that you want to keep the disk. You create a new VM with multiple NICs, attach the disk, and turn it on again.
So nobody likes do-overs, and You know, honest to Pete, if you spent as much time with Andres as I do, this is his answer multiple times every day. So it's very easy for you to say we can automate rebuilding a VM with Azure Automation. So how long is that going to take me to go sort that out?
Well, it wouldn't be too complicated. All you have to do is just sit down and wait a couple of hours, and then there is a script at contoso.se that you can download and put it into Azure Automation.
All right, okay, so you've written an Azure Automation script that will do this. All right, so at the end of the deck, we'll have a resource download deck, so just make sure you come back tomorrow, get the PowerPoint off the System Center Universe site, and Anders will give you a script, so if you create a virtual machine with a single NIC and you need to jump that up to 2 or 4, you can use his little PowerShell snippet to make that happen. So let's talk about optimizing VMs a little further. Let's just think this through. You've got your VM up, it's running. You know, sometimes it's important not to overthink things. You know, at the end of the day, Azure Infrastructure as a Service is not all that different from, you know, Hyper-V in your data center, right? An Azure VM is just a VM. It's the underlying fabric that's fundamentally different in a couple of ways. So, you know, that being said, you know, Windows operating system optimizations, you know, little tweaks we do in Unix and Linux, those are still, you know, perfectly applicable. The world, you know, isn't turned on its ear just because we move that from the data center up to Azure. You know, Azure's great. It's not magic. So when you patch an operating system, you can still reboot. Microsoft patching the fabric behind the scenes technically can reboot a system. So we need to think about availability. We need to think about optimizing as well. You know, it's one thing in our data center when I create a virtual machine to run, say, a System Center workload, and I go give it a couple of extra cores. I give it a little bit of memory, you know, a little bit more than I should. Now, there are a whole bunch of reasons you shouldn't do that in the data center, but it doesn't have a direct cost like it does in Azure. When I go flipping switches and I go from an A1 to an A4, from an A6 to a D5, you know, I'm paying for that by the minute, so it has a very real, very concrete, yes, quantifiable cost.
So even if you're in your data center, you would be paying even if you're not using it. Let's say you're buying a Hyper-V host, you're not using it, you still pay. So that's a big benefit running it in Azure. Well, you can terminate it any minute.
Well, if I can turn it off, but if I turn it on and it's running and it's too big, I'm paying more than I need to. So we ask this question and answer it quite a bit. You know, how long can I run on $200? And I pick $200 because that's exactly how much money Microsoft gives you in a trial Azure subscription, $200. So the answer depends on what we deploy. So you can see here that ranges from, if I deploy an A1, I can run for darn near 3 months. If I deploy a G5, I can run for less than 20 hours. Now that's before.
Yeah, so if we have a Godzilla machine, we could add like 32 disks?
64 disks.
64 disks. So if we put that on there and we also add a little bit of load on the machine, I think we can get down to like 8, 7, maybe 5 hours.
I'll take that as a personal challenge, but if somebody ever asks you the question, you know, how much does Godzilla eat? You know, the answer is $200 about every 20 hours.
Yep.
So more or less. So just bearing that in mind. Let's talk about Azure storage. So Microsoft has a single storage platform for Azure, which differentiates it from some of the other clouds out there, some of the other platforms. But I said when we deploy an Azure virtual machine, it's just a VM, right? So the operating system has an OS driver. It's going to call a disk. The OS is going to talk to the hypervisor. The hypervisor in Azure has some interesting caching capability. And the caching is local to the host. So there are going to be some situations where I might enable read cache. There's even a temporary disk in every Azure virtual machine that runs on D. And it's all local to the host, which means we're not calling down to the storage, so that can be good, but maybe not always.
Not always.
Where it gets interesting is when that hypervisor makes a call down to the storage, because it's not iSCSI, it's not Fibre Channel, it's actually a RESTful web service call. It's calling a RESTful API. So I can improve my I/O by adding multiple disks to my Azure VMs and doing a number of different configurations, which we'll talk about in a minute. But what I can't control is the latency in this call to the RESTful API. The call is the call. You know, I would say in most of the tests we've done, we see single and very low double-digit latencies there in the call. So the REST API is very, very fast.
Yeah.
It's just architecturally sort of unique. I am going to get very tired looking at this photo before this is over.
So noisy neighbors. This is, I met your neighbors, Pete. They're quite nice.
Well, my neighbors are actually very, very much guilty of cooking more crawfish than I want to eat most months. What is a noisy neighbor in Azure terms?
Yeah, so a noisy neighbor. So in Azure, on a host, you are not alone there. There are many other customers running on that host. And so if they are putting a lot of load on the local disks there, that will affect your performance too. So in some scenarios, it's better to turn off cache and just go straight to the Azure storage service instead.
Yeah, so we should talk about that caching. There's actually three flavors of caching in Azure. So it starts when you deploy a VM. The default caching mode for your operating system disk is going to be read-write. Typically, we say leave that the heck alone. You can set it to read-only. I can't think of a situation where I've ever been advised or felt like I needed to do that. Read caching, I think we could think of some obvious scenarios there where we're reading from a sequential set of files, etc. You know, the thing about read caching is it's going to be helpful if you're actually hitting the cache, if you're calling data that's, you know, you've used before. If you're not hitting the cache, you're just spending more cycles, costing yourself a bit of performance, right? None is a great caching option for disk-intensive workloads. So think SQL Server, where I put my data disks out there and I put my database and log files. None's going to be a very good, a very safe, a very common starting point. So let's talk about increasing IOPS. So 500 IOPS, one disk.
That's for a standard machine?
That's for a standard tier. You know, out of the box isn't enough, so we want to start ratcheting up. How do we do that in a platform where we don't have a physical storage array sitting there that we can look at? Well, we can add disks, and Anders will show you how to add disks if you've never had one. We can create a stripe set, think software RAID, just like you would do in the interface in Windows, just like we've done for the last, all the way back to NT4. Or we could use storage spaces. So I guess I'm going to look at Anders now and ask you, why would I use storage spaces and not just hook up some disks and set up a stripe set in my guest?
That's a very good question, Pete.
I'm full of good questions.
Yeah. So
I'm full of other things too, but
I know. I have noticed that.
Like so, crap, but okay.
So when you do software RAID or when you do RAID inside of a VM in Azure, that's software RAID. So that means that you would use CPU performance to do RAID operations.
Yeah, so there's a little more overhead in other
words. Yeah, exactly. So it's stealing a little bit of the CPU performance. Also from a performance perspective, using storage spaces will give you a little bit more performance. And also then you get it like a central storage. It's easier for you to administrate, easier for you to expand and rebuild and so on. So storage spaces is really the recommended way.
Yeah, so central storage at that point gives me a single point of management. It means TCO, admin effort.
Yeah,
all of that is going to be net easier.
Yeah, and talking about RAID, it's also important to remember that fault tolerance RAID, Azure has that in Fabric, so you don't have to think about building it inside of your VM. With the lowest settings, you still have 3 copies of your data inside of a data center.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to talk about redundancy of the storage layer in just a bit, but good point. Option two, you could opt for a VM that has premium storage. It can get us heading in that 50,000 IOPS direction, and you can imagine that's great for performance. It's also not free.
it's not free.
Yeah. So for folks like us, we can also just optimize our IOPS. So we look at our SQL queries, for example. We configure our applications in optimal ways, so they cache what they can in memory to reduce our calls out to the storage tier. That's always a great place to begin.
Oh, backup. This is really good.
Anders, you're always very excited. I'm never excited to talk about backup, I have to be honest.
This is good.
But this is going to be interesting. So we'll talk about 4 backup options today. So let's start with the Azure Backup Service, which is a
fantastic service.
It is a great service. It's a SaaS offering from Microsoft, so I can back up my application and my OS workload straight into Azure Blob storage, straight into that storage tier. It's 20 cents a gig beyond the free tier, which maybe seems like a bit of money. We can look at other options. You know, technically, System Center Data Protection Manager is supported in Azure VM. So I could just deploy DPM in an Azure VM, and I could install DPM and start.
This one looks a little bit cheaper.
Well, it does, right? Yeah. So it's five. You know, it's
at the first
five, you're plain old blob storage is 5-ish cents a gig, but then we've got to think about somebody to take care of DPM. We've installed DPM on one virtual machine at least. We've probably set up that storage space as VM, so we've got some storage out there, which means we're now incurring some compute cost. So there's the pain in the rear expense, right?
Yeah. For so the total cost might be a little bit. It really depends where you are today. If you have already bought DPM, you have a lot of knowledge already running it, maybe it's easier to move it.
Yeah, I've met people that go both ways. It kind of depends on your situation. If you have, you know, DPM capabilities or good backup engineers in spades, then you might want to go that route. You know, in SQL 2014, and actually in previous versions of SQL, if you download the Azure backup tool for those, you can back up your SQL databases straight to blob storage. So that's not going to the Azure backup service. That's going straight into blob storage. And there's a SQL performance white paper we're going to point you to. And that's actually one of the things on their quick list is back up your SQL databases to Azure Blob Storage, because it's easy. It's actually quite easy for your DBAs to take care of that, so there's not a lot of hand-holding required in that respect. So certainly you could also write a script and dump your Windows backups to Blob Storage.
Yeah.
You know, I would think in a medium or large environment, that's probably going to be a bit more of an edge case. I see a couple of you taking notes, and I love people that take notes, but just know that you will get the PowerPoint in exactly this form and a recording of this after the fact. So if you want to relax knowing that, we want you to enjoy yourself.
Maybe they're writing something else.
Maybe they're writing something else. Yeah, it could be writing a Dear John letter or something.
It could be. One thing here to really stress is that when you buy a virtual machine in Azure, you're just buying the virtual machine. So there is no secret backup in the background here. Same with what we said earlier around patching. It's all up to you, so it's really important to remember that the machines in Azure, they need to be backupped in some way, exactly as all your machines that you have on-prem today.
Yeah, that's very true. So these VMs are your babies, gentlemen, so who says we can't have babies? So why don't you get in and show us some storage optimization? So we're gonna let Anders show us a few things, and we'll learn a few lessons as we're going through here for how we tune up our storage.
Right, so the first one, if we go in here,
keep talking.
Yeah. Will you come back later, or should I just?
I will. I just want to make sure that we can see.
Great.
You may need to zoom actually, because it's a little foggy.
Should we zoom?
As you're getting into something, you want us to actually see. Yeah.
Yep. Good. So when looking at the disks for virtual machines here in the Azure portal, if you go in and list all your disks, you can click on one of the disks, and you can see that you can change the cache preference here, if you want non-cache, if you want read-only or read-write. So it really depends on what kind of workload you have on your server. And there are some recommendations. For example, for SQL, there is a great white paper you can download. They will recommend everything here, all the settings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the first one. Then if you want to add disks to your VM and build a software RAID, it's quite simple. You pick a server, you go down here, and you just click Add Disk. And then you just add a disk, very simple. And then you configure a RAID part inside of the operation system.
So talk to us about redundancy in our storage.
Yeah, so if we go into storage, we have our different storage accounts here. And each one of our storage accounts will deliver maximum 20,000 IOPS. That's a good thing to know. So we had 500 on the standard disks, 300 on the basic disks, and 20,000 on our storage account.
Yeah, so you need to think about that. If you're trying to hit that 50,000 IO limit, you're going to be spreading your disk across multiple storage accounts at that point.
So we go into one of our storage accounts, and we click Configure, and you can see here that we can configure our replication settings. So we can do local redundant. That means that you will get three copies within the data center. That's good.
That's better than we don't have three copies in most of our on-prem data centers,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. We can do geo-redundant, meaning that we will have three copies in our local data center, and we have three copies in another region.
Okay, so let's talk about that for a second. So geo-redundancy is also the default when I create a VM, right?
Exactly. That's a bit tricky.
So do we want geo-redundancy really, or is local better?
In some cases, from a performance perspective, it's better to do local redundancy. And also from a pricing perspective, it's better to do local.
Yeah, so local tends to be good enough if you have a backup strategy in place. Here's one other important thing I want you to write down, okay? If you set up a disk array, if we had multiple disks, stripe them, et cetera, If you make those critters geo-redundant, you're in for some problems because we can't guarantee write order when you're geo-redundant. So locally redundant is going to be the only way to fly. And typically, even in production workloads, locally redundant is how we're running 99% of the time.
Yeah. But it's a good thing to remember that by default it's geo-redundant. You might want to set up a template deploying with local redundant.
Yeah, but it's you know, typically as good, it's as good for performance, and it's cheaper. And I'm all about cheaper, so.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then read access, geo-redundant. It's the same as geo-redundant, just that you can also read from the secondary region. So it's quite nice if the first one goes offline, you can read from the secondary one. It costs a little bit extra, but if you have for some reason an application that requires it, just click it and you will get it. Very nice. Yeah. Anything more you want to add, Pete?
I think that's good for a first pass. We wanted to get that locally versus geo redundant out there. Just remember the geo is the default, so you want to keep your eyeballs on that when you're provisioning. Let's talk about Active Directory for a moment. So is there anybody in here who doesn't have Active Directory in your environment today? All right, so when we connect our corporate data center to Azure, we're creating now another physical data center one way or another. So we pick, whether we pick US West, US East, we now have another location where we're deploying VMs, and they need to authenticate in a manner that's physically proximate to that VM. So our Active Directory strategy is going to be really important to authentication, performance, and by association, user experience. So domain controller placement. It makes really good sense to deploy a virtual machine in every Azure data center where you have virtual machines running. You'll also want to go into Active Directory sites and services. Just as when you bring up a new location, physically in your corporate infrastructure, when I stand up a new Azure regional, VNet, I need to go add those VNets to Active Directory sites and services. I need a site, an Active Directory site for the data center. I need to add the subnets for each of the subnets within my Azure virtual network. I need to assign that domain controller a static IP. When I take that critter down, I want it to have the same address when it comes back up. If you go back to the first or second session this morning, Martin showed us how to add a static IP through the Azure portal. Authentication. So there's a magic equation for authenticating locally with Active Directory, and that's what we need: a domain controller, a global catalog role, and a DNS server all in the same location for authentication to happen. So DC plus GC plus DNS. So make sure you have all of those roles local to your Azure VNet. So for those of you running Active Directory in 2012, there's also the read-only domain controller role, which in theory, since it's not writable, means that we can save some traffic leaving our Azure subscription because we're not replicating any changes out, we're only replicating changes in. At the end of the day, that may cause some problems with some legacy applications. So if you have legacy apps dispersed through your environment, you want to test those or just make sure that they're okay with a copy of AD that's not writable. And if you don't know, frankly, it might be easier just to use, a full-blown, AD replica at that point.
Oh, this also, yeah. This is a good, this is also the good slide.
Here's a warning that we felt worth mentioning. So when you shut down a virtual machine from outside the guest operating system, it's fundamentally different from shutting the VM down from within the guest operating system. Tell me the difference.
Yes. So when you shut it down from inside of the operating system, we will still keep the VM running on the host. But if you shut down the VM from outside, from the portal or from PowerShell, we will deallocate the VM, meaning that we will not keep it on a host anymore. We will remove it from the host. And there are two things to remember there, that as long as you have it shut down from inside of the host, from the VM, you're still paying because you're still reserving the resources. So even if you shut down the machines, you're not really processing anything in there. You're still paying because you're still reserving the resources on the host. So for that reason, you might want to do the deallocation.
So it's cheap. It's less expensive, so I might want to shut it down.
Exactly,
right?
To save a little bit of money there.
So every action has its consequences, and when we're dealing with a domain controller, there are some special consequences we want to think about. So shutting down that virtual machine from outside the guest, so I go to the Azure portal, I highlight the VM, and I say shut down, and it's shut down and deallocated. That's nothing unusual. It's what happens when we bring that Active Directory domain controller back online where things start to get interesting.
Yeah, things can be a little bit in a bad mood.
Active Directory does express some concern, let's say. So there's a VM generation ID and an invocation ID that were brought about in some safeguards in Windows Server 2012 around cloning and around snapshots. Because lots of people like to create snapshots of their VMs, and creating snapshots of Active Directory domain controllers is bad.
It's a really good feature.
It's bad. But when we bring that virtual machine up, its VM generation ID is actually different. So it gets put back on a host, it powers up, its VM generation ID is different, its invocation ID is different, and this is actually going to trigger AD replication safeguards, which include a non-authoritative restore process through no action on your part. Does that sound like a good thing to anybody in here, by a show of hands? Smack that guy. The bottom line is it's probably going to be okay, but there's really no reason to press it. And I can't think of a production scenario where I have a lot of call to shut down and deallocate a VM that's running Active Directory, right?
And when you do this restore process, no client can communicate with the DC either. So if you only have one DC in Azure and all your Azure machines are supposed to communicate with it, then yeah, that can affect them a little bit.
Yeah, so in many Active Directory environments, that's not going to be that big a deal. If you're a very large organization, that process can take a few minutes.
Yeah.
Depending on your bandwidth, you know, it may take more than a few minutes. So you just want something you want to think about as you're deploying. Let's talk about SQL Server in Azure VMs for a minute. And let's start with licensing, which is a very unsexy topic, but it's important, right? So we're talking about optimizing, because at the end of the day, you have to justify to the organization why we're spending money. So you can go to the Azure Gallery, and I can pick a virtual machine that has SQL already installed. And that includes the SQL license. So the challenge there is I'm paying more per minute for that virtual machine than I would pay for a plain Windows VM. So if I have my own SQL license already, I probably just want to install Windows, install SQL myself. It's going to give me, you know, a little greater control out of the box as I'm customizing.
So the ones from the gallery is quite handy if you're a test and dev scenario. So you just want to spin up a SQL, do some tests, maybe a couple of days, a couple of hours, for example. But if you want to deploy a production SQL server, then you might want to do some customization, some special settings, adding disks, get a better performance, and so on. And then, then you maybe don't using the ones from the gallery. Instead, you're building your SQL server yourself.
Yeah, there's certainly a convenience factor there. And if you have an MSDN subscription and you have a developer that wants to test some stuff, there's actually a VM image out there in the gallery that has Visual Studio, SQL Server, and SharePoint all installed in the same VM. So that's super handy and can make a dev happy potentially. Also, think about SQL Platform as a service. You can actually, in SQL's Platform as a service, click a button and say, give me a new SQL instance, and Azure will do that. And I can say, create me a database, and Azure will do that. And I can use a script to, you know, script my table structure, et cetera. So I like doing that sometimes. Platform as a service is something as IT pros we kind of tend to shy away from. But the fact of the matter is, if I have a dev who has some .NET apps and a SQL backend and they want to test an app, PaaS is going to be interesting. Because you remember that A1 virtual machine, we said you could run that for like 87 days on $200. Mm-hmm. So Anders and I actually use SQL PaaS for some of our reference databases that we go back and refer to with our runbook automation.
I think we have it in a demo later.
Yeah. So how many days could I run, how long could I run a SQL PaaS database for versus spinning up a VM and installing SQL and all that?
Yeah, at least much more than 19 hours.
Yeah, I could run a SQL, our little reference databases, I could run them for years on $200. We're talking about pennies a day. So there's going to be a time where it's less a pain for you, it's a whole lot cheaper. And in platform as a service, you still get virtual machines. They're just not persistent. I can remote into them. I can install apps, et cetera. It's not alien. It's a Windows instance. So you want to poke around and think about that a bit. We've actually got some resource links that'll point you to some of that sort of thing for IT pros. So let's get out of licensing and the money end of things and talk about performance. So again, in some respects, we come back to what we said a few minutes ago, which is don't overthink stuff. There are some performance do's that that we use on-prem. You know, for example, we take our database and our log files and we put them on separate data disks, right? I might take Kent in his ConfigMan book, talks about taking TempDB and cutting that into multiple files, one per core. I can still do that in Azure. I might use database page compression. I might use instant file initialization. Actually, in that SQL performance white paper, there are a lot of tips there. There are also some pretty common sense things we don't want to do. Don't use the D drive, the temporary disk. Don't ever put your database files on a temporary disk because it's transient data. When that VM goes down and comes back up, there's stuff that's not going to be there that was there when you hit the shutdown button. And I don't care what you read, you know, don't put, you know, TempDB or anything else over there. Don't, and notice the don't in the top here, right? Don't enable geo-replication for your storage account unless you have a business reason for doing so, because again, that's going to increase our spend. Stay away from auto-grow, auto-shrink. These are pretty common sense things with system center workloads for sure, right? You know, particularly for my OpsMan DB, my ConfigMan DB, I'm not going to be auto-growing most of the time. So just some food for thought.
Oh, what will I do?
So, heaven forbid, what does Anders have to say now?
Well, I would just recommend this white paper. It's really good. It includes like all kind of tips and tricks for running SQL Server inside of a VM in Azure. You should really read it. And if you don't really have time to read it, you should still read the quick checklist.
Yeah, there's actually a quick checklist on page 5 that has a list of everything you should and shouldn't do that's described in this white paper. So it's great for you. It's great for your DBAs. You can get yourselves on the same page about how we take workloads off-prem into Azure, and we get it right on the first iteration.
Ta-da! Demo. Everyone has been waiting.
Finally. Everyone has been waiting.
Yes. So when about to move SQL Server to Azure, there are, of course, a lot of recommendations in that white paper. And there is also a tool that you can use.
And it's not the only tool you can use. You
no.
can also, you guys are all familiar with the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit, right?
The MAP Toolkit?
Yeah, so the MAP Toolkit will scan your VMs and give you a lot of good information. At the end of the day, it's great to have some insight
into
the boss.
But that's only for sizing. So it will record your machine, collect performance data, and will recommend like you should go with this VM size.
Dude, take the win. I'm just setting the softball up for you here. Go.
Yeah, but it will not do any like check on the workflow. But this tool, the virtual machine, readiness assessment tool, it can do a little bit of deeper check. So it works for AD, SharePoint, and SQL Server. So we pick SQL Server here. And the first part here is a couple of questions you have to go through about your workload you have on your SQL Server. Yep, we have all the permissions. Go through these questions. So I think it's 10 questions. And if you don't really know, you just click unsure.
So can anybody guess what this wizard's going to tell you if you say that you do use SSD storage on site? It's going to take you to premium storage.
We'll always end up with a big one. Nah. So this is good. Yeah, we click here. Yep, yes, local to your company. Yep. I will do test, a little bit of dev also. So I go through all these questions around how do you administrate your machine, how do you back them up, what kind of workflow do you have there today, workload, how much IOPS do you use, and so on. How will you, for example, deploy? I'm not really sure how I will deploy it. Like that. Then we just input the name of the SQL Server. Like that. And it will start detecting the environment and start collecting data. And as we only have 21 more minutes, I have pre-cooked this a little bit. So let's go in here.
Yeah, so take us back to the title page. At the end of the day, you get a very nice report.
Exactly. So here we have the report. I will zoom out a little bit like this. It will explain a lot for you. It will explain all about moving to Azure and a lot of special settings for SQL Server. For example, if we scroll down a little bit to page, let's say, like 23, for example. Here.
Give me some zoom here. I'm old. I can't see that.
Let's go down here.
So the bottom line, you're getting some very specific guidance here. You're getting some links out to additional reading, et cetera, so you don't have to be a rocket scientist when you start clicking the buttons here. It's definitely going to give you capability to go out and consume what you need when you need it.
Yeah, so you get this little warning icon here saying that something you should review how you're using the D drive, because the D drive is reserved for the temporary disk in Azure. So you can read about it, and you also, as Pete said here, you get this good link so you can read more about what you should do. So just run this against your SQL server and go through all the findings in the report.
Yeah. And this report is Pete approved. I'm in favor of anything that makes it look like I've done far more work than I've actually done. So great report to show the boss and take to the team when you're ready to make this happen.
Yeah, so it's a really handy tool.
All right, enough about the...
Yeah, I think so.
Enough assessing.
Oh, this is really good.
Yeah, so yeah. I think an important, and I don't know of a better way to say this, you know, Azure is actually designed to fail, and that's a very good thing. You know, there's two things I think are very true. I hate platforms that don't plan for failure, and, you know, applications that aren't instrumented to be monitored. So Azure is designed for failure. So we're going to touch again briefly on geo-redundant storage, but we want to talk to you about three or four very cool concepts in Azure around high availability. We're going to touch on availability sets. We're going to move into load balance sets. Anybody in here ever done NLB? Yeah, okay. We have something very, very, very cool for you, three varies. We're going to talk about Traffic Manager, and we're going to look at auto scale as well. And we'll touch briefly on SQL Always On availability groups, you know, something you may be familiar with System Center anyway. So let's get into it. Let's start with availability sets. So we mentioned at the end of the day, VMs in Azure IaaS are just VMs. Somewhere down there in the fabric, your virtual machine is running on a host. That host is, you know, servers in the rack, et cetera. So what we can do with an availability set is tell Azure, for example, with the nodes in our web farm, we'd like you to keep these VMs close to one another, but not so close that they all go down at the same time. So an availability set will break those virtual machines up into fault domains, which means in circumstances of hardware failure or where we're patching the fabric, we're not going to lose our entire application. Really important fact, when you have a single virtual machine, the SLA for a single VM is no SLA. So availability sets actually give us that capability to guarantee some availability. If you ever read the Azure contract, you'll find that there are not a lot of promises made for a single VM. Exactly. So availability set gives us that capability.
Exactly. So the fault domain, that's about hardware, and the update domain is about software.
Yeah. So we'll get to that. So load balance sets is much like network load balancing on-prem, which I always thought was a lot of work to set up and a little bit smarter than I was. That's not saying a lot, but in Azure, load balance sets are like NLB, except it's way, way, way easier. So we're dealing with layer 4, you know, session awareness, you know, source and destination IP, port protocol, et cetera. The difference being that when we set up a load balance set, it's less than 5 clicks. I think it's exactly 4 clicks.
Yeah, I think we did it on 4 clicks before. But one thing to add here is that network load balancing is not even supported inside of a VM in Azure. There are a couple of roles and features that are not supported to install on a VM running in Azure. Most likely, the feature is already in Fabric, so you really don't want to have it inside of a VM, like this example. It's just easier to have it in Fabric.
Yeah.
If you want to read about all the features and functions that are not supported, there is a knowledge base article. I think the number is 27216126. 672, yeah? That includes a list, yes.
I'll take your word for that, Doctor. Yeah, we'll make sure that's in the downloads. So let's talk about Traffic Manager for a moment
like
here.
Like a fancy DNS?
Traffic Manager is exactly like that. It's fancy DNS. So it starts by us putting a CNAME record in our corporate DNS. So for contoso.com in this case, for www.contoso.com, I have a CNAME that points to a Traffic Manager domain. And when I configure Traffic Manager, I tell it where I have applications, where I have my application installed in Azure. So this, generally speaking, assumes that you have your application installed in multiple Azure data centers. Now, how Traffic Manager directs your users to those data centers depends on the load balancing mechanism you choose. So if I use the failover algorithm, Basically, all my traffic is going to go to the primary until the availability check that traffic manager is doing sees that that primary is down, then it's going to cut over to the backup. If I use the performance option, it's going to route folks based on a response-specific mechanism there. So if I'm in North America and I host my application in North America and I have a copy over here in APAC, you know, the folks in Asia Pacific will typically go to that data center. North America is going to come here. And then there's actually a round robin option as well.
Yeah, like Robinhood.
Yeah, which kind of spreads the love to everybody, right? So it's a little smarter than DNS round robin, though, because it's not going to send people to endpoints that are down. Very important distinction here. Traffic manager is directing where people go. The traffic is not flowing through traffic manager, though. This is simply, it feels a lot like fancy DNS to me.
So
let's look at availability sets.
Yes.
I think there are a couple of other little lessons we want to kind of share with you out of availability sets while we're... I can't hear. I'm going to come back here.
Oh, a little bit older.
Say again? Persistence? Persistence in NLB? Oh, okay, let's take it offline, and it's a lot like NLB, but let's take that offline and we'll go down that rabbit hole over here after if you have time.
Right, so here I have one of my service manager machines. I want to put this into an availability set. It's quite easy. I just click on the machine, configure, availability set, select availability set. So I can pick one of the, if I already had one, I could pick that one. So I can just do a new one, service manager. Oh, like that. Yes. So it's a good thing if your machine is already shut down, else it will be.
Yeah, so you can put existing VMs into an availability set if they're not already, but Azure's going to shut them down for you to do that.
Yeah.
Good point.
So now it will be baking this in the background for a little while.
Yeah, so while this is cooking, flip over to those slides and let's look. We actually have a four-node availability set. Let's look at how fault domains and update domains are handled. So
yes.
Fault domains being all about the hardware, updates being about, you know, patching the fabric.
So here we have four web servers, and this is the first one. And once you have deployed it and you have set up the availability set, as we just did in the demo, you can use PowerShell to look at the settings.
Yeah,
yes.
So you see he's just using a single line of PowerShell here to pull back the settings to see what his details are.
This first one, we can see it's running in fault domain 0 and upgrade domain 0. Nothing strange there. We go to the next one. We can see it's in fault domain 1, upgrade domain 1. So we have one fault domain, one upgrade domain.
Well, so now we have 0 and 1 fault domains. We have two fault domains.
Two.
We have two update. We have two upgrade domains as well. Okay.
Very good. We're adding one more web server into that availability set.
Okay.
This one goes to fault domain 0, upgrade domain 2.
Okay.
So we are... You're keeping track?
Two fault domains, three upgrade domains.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. So now we're adding one more.
One more.
Number four.
So
it's back to fault domain 0 and upgrade domain 0.
So we still have two fault domains. So summarize and let's kind of see where we landed.
So we have the racks, the fault domains, and we have the upgrade domains.
All right. So update domains, we had three, right?
One, two, three. Yep.
Okay, now let's see what our fault domains look like. All right, so that's not what I expected.
No.
So I have three VMs in the same fault domain, which means if the wrong host goes down in the fabric, I lose 75% of my capacity. So at the end of the day, and I don't remember when we first encountered this, but I'm glad we encountered this at some point in history. So I want a single, go back with me here, I want a single load balance set, but I want to make sure that those critters are, you know, two and two in fault domains, right? So I lose as little as of my capacity at a time as I want. So how can I work around that?
So what you could do is that you create, in this case, we have four web servers. So we create two availability sets, put two machines into each availability set, and then we create a network load balancing set on top of that. So we're still sending requests to all four machines, but we have two different availability sets. I can show it in here. Because now the first service manager machine is in its availability set, and now I can just go to the next one. So now I'm O2 here.
And the reason he's showing you this and the reason it's so important is there's no magic button for me to go tell Azure, hey, you got it wrong, and I want you to split those up two and two, right?
Exactly. So here I can now pick my service manager availability set, and I can see that SM01 is already in there. So what Pete was saying about network load balancing set now, mm-hmm. that we will come to, but to give this to get the SLA on the VMs, it's quite easy just to deploy a couple of them and put them into the same availability set. So if we want to see how the other thing looks.
Yeah, but how many fault domains am I going to have if I have 4 VMs in an availability set?
2.
And if I have 8 VMs in an availability
2.
Set?
2.
So the answer is always 2 fault domains,
yeah.
right? So think about that when you go above 2 in an availability set and think about kind of splitting those out.
So here we have the 4 machines, and we have put them into 2 availability sets that you can see here. System Center Universe set 02, and I have 2 machines in there. If I go to the next one, System Center Universe set 01, 2 machines in there. So they are actually divided on 2 different availability sets. And then on top of that, we have configured endpoints and a network load balancing set, System Center Universe Web, where we have put all the 4 machines in there. So all requests are still divided over all the 4 machines.
Indeed.
Fancy.
Good. So let's talk about auto scaling. This is a very, you know, I'm really excited about network load balancing and, you know, load balance sets and traffic manager, but auto scale is something that's very, very interesting for pay-as-you-go environments because it's, you know, one thing on-prem to build my SharePoint front ends to be really big to handle that 9 a.m. spike. In Azure, that really sucks, right? Because I'm paying for the big all the time. So I want to think about scaling out as opposed to just scaling up right from the start. So that's where autoscale can be really, really handy. So in Azure Platform as a Service, where the virtual machines are not persistent, you basically tell Azure, I wanna have at least this many instances, so maybe that's 3, and I say, hey, I wanna go to 10 max. I install my application, and then as my demand dictates, autoscale will turn those instances on, and as my demand ebbs and flows, it will turn them on and off automatically. It creates instances and removes them as it needs to. In infrastructure as a service, if you want control of the whole virtual machine, that's totally your prerogative, you need to create those VMs and configure them ahead of time. And then you power them down, and you tell AutoScale what your minimum and maximum are, and it will turn those on and turn those off. But at the end of the day, that means you're paying for the storage there. I mean, certainly paying for the storage is much less than paying for the compute, right?
Yeah.
So you've got some capability there to scale out. So I think that's a really important lesson to take away when you're thinking about pay-as-you-go environments. Think about scaling out, not just up. Your auto-scale triggers are going to be your average CPU utilization. So I can say, hey, when you hit 80% on all these, I want you to add more, turn more on. And then we can look at the message, you know, the request in queue, and take the same actions there. So something to think about. Why don't you get in and show us?
Oh, this is a fantastic demo.
So we've been waiting for a while for Azure for Anders to show us something in Azure automation. So what are we going to talk about here?
We always have to show a little bit of automation, Pete. So in Azure, we can use Azure Automation. It's a service where we can build our runbooks and we can automate our Azure environment. So I go into my automation account here. Should we just take a minute, just look at it? It's so beautiful.
I think this baby is beautiful to you.
So nice.
Okay, so what is this baby going to do?
So in here, I have written a runbook in PowerShell workflow. I will go and find it.
Okay.
I have it here. So we go and look at the code. So I will not go in too deep here, but if you want a copy, it's also on contoso.se, so you can just download a copy there. What it will do is that it will connect to a Azure SQL database, so it's a PaaS database. It's not a full-blown SQL server that I need to administrate. It's just a database.
Okay, what's in this database?
So what's in this database is here. So I have a database, I have one table, and in here I have
Can you zoom for me?
Please.
Give me some zoom.
If I do the demos, Pete, you do.
Well, there's a reason you do the demos. You have to zoom for me, though. So I'm quite old, so. Yeah, so basically, he's using a table here to store a list of virtual machines, right?
So here's the table. So I have a couple of machines, and I have one column saying what should be the size during night, one should be the size during day. As Pete said earlier, you're paying for every minute you're using these machines. So if you can shut down a machine or scale down it a little bit when you're not using it, you're saving money.
Let me tell you why what he's showing you here is so awesome. So I said you need to think about scaling out, right? Which is very easy for me to say until you go to your devs and they say, well, you know, we didn't write this app to scale out, so have a nice day.
Yeah.
So I need to scale up at that point. What Andres is giving you here is a scheduled way to go in and scale up by taking a machine offline and bumping the image size, right?
Exactly. So here I can click schedule and I can connect this runbook to a schedule. So I can tell it to run every evening around 10 o'clock, for example, shut down all these machines, scale down these machines, and then in the morning run another runbook, scale up these machines to this size, and start these machines.
There we go.
Quite handy.
Another fantastic piece of Swedish engineering.
Absolutely.
Not available at IKEA.
Then you need to build it yourself. Yeah. So, and it's really nice here because Azure Automation as a service and the PaaS database also as a service. So I really don't need to host my own automation infrastructure. I don't need to host my own SQL server. I just use the tools in here. It's really simple to build it.
Yeah, so make sure you come grab these. They're all free. We've got some additional scripts out there for you around creating your own SQL PaaS databases if you're you decide you're into that sort of thing. So
let's finish it up.
We are going to thankfully only see this one last time.
This one is good, of course. So when you're about to start working with Azure, you have to realize that you need to learn PowerShell. So the portal is nice. Martin showed us a lot of good features in the portal, but there will always be more settings and more features in PowerShell. So when starting to work with Azure, make sure you start using PowerShell. And of course, if you start working with PowerShell, it's not far away to go to Azure Automation, and you can automate everything.
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually, Azure Automation is PowerShell workflow, but there's an inline script tag that'll allow you to drop a lot of your PowerShell scripts in there with some limitations, but definitely worth digging into. So you've got some samples with actual functions to get your feet wet in Azure Automation if you like. So
time to summarize.
Summarize. Yeah. So hopefully you've taken away 2 or 3 or 4 or 12 tips. You know, out of this session today. I know Anders and I have been wandering through Azure for a couple of years pretty hard now. And not all of these, you know, some of these lessons came easily, not all of them,
nope,
for sure. So there'll be a recording after the show, some links. So Anders said he would put that rebuild script out there, so that'll be out there in a couple of hours. You'll be able to get the link out of this deck tomorrow-ish, I believe. So.
Good.
Come back, get the recording, grab the resources, and thanks for playing along today.
Thank you.